This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. The other voice you heard during the community calendar is that of Sands Hall, who has probably been on this program more than any other local writer, where it's always some different angle. I don't know where she keeps coming up with them. In this particular case, we have two authors I'm going to talk to this afternoon, both dealing with non-Californians who became very important in this state. And left quite an influence on people who followed past them. The first is Philip Fradkin, a well-known Western environmental historian. His book is Wallace Stegner and the American West. And then in the second half of the program, I'm going to talk with Dale Pendle about his book, Walking with Nobby, his conversations with Norman O'Brown, who became famous on the East Coast but spent the last 30-some years of his life in Santa Cruz. Philip Fradkin, welcome to Booktown.
Nice to be here.
Wallace Stegner's been... Oh, and I should mention that this is Wallace Stegner's 99th birthday.
It is, February 18th, 1909.
Yeah, and he's been dead for about 15 years now. There have already been two biographies. Why did you decide to write a third one?
Primarily because the first two biographies were written by professors of English, and they were literary biographies. They dealt with analyzing the works mostly. The first one was written in 1977 by Forrest Robinson at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Wallace Stegner, he was just actually hitting his stride. And that year, I think it was, or a year to either side of it, he got the National Book Award for Spectator Bird. So that took a look mostly at Stegner's literary output the first three quarters of his life. And then the next book was written by Jackson Benson, was published in 1996. And Mr. Benson had the advantage, which I took advantage of when his papers became accessible at Stanford, of being able to interview most of the people who knew Stegner, his wife, his family, they were all living at the time, and those interviews became available to me. There were some lacks in his book. He was working under the direct supervision of Wallace Stegner. It's a difficult presence to write in front of. Then Stegner died, and his wife, Mary, guarded the flame. So Jackson Benson produced a very workable piece of biography, but I think there were a lot of areas that hadn't been explored that I thought needed being explored.
And now your biography is very sympathetic, but hardly uncritical.
Well, I guess it's sympathetic. I wouldn't use that word. I looked at him as much as any person can with as clear and as fresh a vision as possible. What Benson hadn't done was what I wanted to do, and what Stegner probably would never have let me do if he were living, and that's to give a sense of the whole man. You know, his pluses and his minuses and his victories and defeats.
You divide the book, well, the first three quarters are about his youth in various places in the West, especially in Saskatchewan and Utah. But then the main body of the book is divided into three main sections: talented teacher, reluctant conservationist, and prominent author. How did those three parts of his life fit together, and how did they conflict?
Well, that was another reason for writing the book. No one had given much thought or equal treatment to the three parts of Wallace Stegner, and that was as a teacher, a teacher of writing, as a writer of fiction and nonfiction, and as an activist, a conservation activist. So the first quarter of the book, or the first fifth of the book, I would guess, deals with his youth. And it was a very formative youth, which is why I spend so much time on it. He came out of his youth. He came out of East End, Saskatchewan, and the homestead site that was right on the Canadian border, fairly well formed, although by the time he left Saskatchewan, he was only about 12 years old. He went on to Great Falls for a year, and then on to Salt Lake City, where he was given some polish and had some of the happiest years of his life before leaving for the University of Iowa. So I thought those years were very important, not only in giving a sense of who he was, but also giving the background for much that he wrote about, which was in a large measure autobiographical, and a lot of that is drawn by his experiences as a youth in Saskatchewan and Salt Lake City. So that's why there's a fair amount of space pertaining to his youth. Now, I begin with teaching, and he was a very talented teacher because he taught immediately. Well, he began teaching in graduate school at the University of Iowa at Augustina College, about a few hours away. And he taught from, I think that was 1935 until 1971 when he left Stanford. He would never say he resigned. He didn't. He quit. He had enough. and then there's a little bit of an overlap because in around late 1950s when his friend Benny DeVoto gets on his case and he starts working on dams on the Colorado River, editing a book for Knopf and the Sierra Club, he becomes a reluctant conservationist. Reluctant in the sense that he felt obligated to do it, and he said he had to, always had to get his dander up about an issue before he could do it effectively, and it took time away from his writing. And then the last part of his life, I say successful writer, although I do deal with part of his writing life before then. All of these different components overlap, of course, and that's when he starts work in the late 1960s on Angle of Repose and goes on to The Spectator Bird and Crossing to Safety. With those three titles, he probably has his greatest success. And I do give equal emphasis to all three parts, and if you ask me which part I thought was most important, I couldn't answer that. He made tremendous contributions in all three parts. But all he wanted to do was write fiction. But he had to support himself and his family, so he became a teacher. And as I mentioned, he sort of got dragged into conservation issues, which he took up very enthusiastically, first as an author of Beyond the 100th Meridian, which is a seminal work on the American West, and then as an aide to Stuart Udall, and then on the boards of the Sierra Club, the Wilderness Society, and as chairman of the National Parks Advisory Committee. So what I say in the beginning of the book, when I cite all these three aspects of his life, is that he literally was unclassifiable, if you pay any attention to those three facets.
The full title of your book is Wallace Stegner in the American West. There have been many Western authors, but Stegner seems to be the first one who could really clearly define what it meant to be a Westerner and pass that on to many other people. What did he mean?
What I meant by that title was that I wasn't, nor am I equipped, to write a literary biography. I just have no interest in it. I don't think of books in an analytical sense. I've never written any fiction, and I certainly never taught any fiction classes. So I was not interested in writing a literary biography. I was interested in writing the life of a man, his works, and particularly how he was formed by the landscapes in which he lived. This has been a theme of mine that I started in a book called The Seven States of California, A Natural and Human History. And the first line in that book is something to the effect that in some way I want to show how landscape defines and molds history, destiny, and human character. I did that in a number of books, in a trilogy on earthquakes, in that California book, in a history of Wells Fargo in the American West, in terms of a commercial venture. And I bring my inquiry down to one person, Wallace Stegner, in this book. So that was very clearly one of the components of the book. One of the things that drove me to find an editor, a publishing house, and to bring that inquiry, which I've been sort of interested in since the early 1990s, down to one person. Now I think I've pretty much done with it, and I'm going on to other things.
Stegner himself defined the West very much as the place, the dry place, the place where water really mattered, and also, though, contradicted everybody's image of it as a land of rugged individualism by pointing out how dependent the people who settled the West were on one another and quite often on the distant government.
Very true, Eric. He didn't put to rest, because there's a line in there by one of his students, Larry McMurtry, that myth will always triumph. Reality will come in second place in terms of anything that's written or filmed or perceived about the West. But he did almost more than any other single person get rid of the idea of the West being a garden, a paradise. It's a very arid land, and to him that was the single most important defining feature. And he sets it out, that theme out wonderfully in the book Beyond the 100th Meridian. And he sets it out in a way that he deals with most large themes, and that is not tackling the theme and making that the subject, but finding an example, in this case, water, John Wesley Powell and the Colorado River, and using that as a sort of an emblematic way, a synecdoche, which is his literary term, for getting into a topic through a region, through one aspect of that region, which really has national importance. Unfortunately, he's been pigeonholed as a regional writer, but although he wrote about the region, he wrote about it very knowingly in a way that he thought could be applied elsewhere. And that was, in the West and elsewhere, you have to deal with the realities of the land and the realities of what's made the history that's occurred on that land. And in the West, as he made very clear, it was people working together, communities, irrigation districts, farmers groups, what have you. And it wasn't the rugged individual Rambo type character who rumbled around the West shooting off his mouth in a six gun.
We could talk probably for the entire interview about some of his students, people like Ken Kesey and Wendell Berry, Larry McMurtry, and so on. We could talk about many of his novels or his conservation work. But the longest single chapter in your book, I think, is the one having to do with his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Angle of Repose. And that's the one that Sands Hall, who's sitting opposite me, has also had a great involvement with, because she wrote her play, Fair Use, almost exactly on that topic of what, how much Stegner might have plagiarized from Mary Halleck Foote and how much he might have changed her life, and whether these were laudable or ignoble activities. How do you see the whole question of Stegner and his writing of Angle of Repose? And I'll say that Sands is sitting here. She may speak up, or she may just hold her peace for the whole time.
I can't imagine the latter case. but I would welcome her discussion, because she was very helpful when I visited Nevada City, and I use with her permission, because it probably exceeded fair use, a large block of text from her play. I think the play is a very level-headed look at the issue. To read it is a little difficult, because it's really made to be either performed or read. One character morphs into another, and it's a little hard to follow a reading, but I would hope someday that I could see it performed, and I found it very useful. So your question is, how do I, the first question is, why did I devote a relatively large amount of space to this issue? And I wasn't really aware of there being such an issue when I first got the idea of writing a biography of Wallace Stegner. I had read the novel in the early 1970s. I had actually also taken my son and gone to see the opera on the bicentennial year in San Francisco. And then in late 2003, I got a letter from Paige Stegner asking me if I had any letters from his father, because he was beginning work on a volume of selected letters, and I didn't have, but that gave me the idea for a biography of Wallace Stegner. So I set to work, and it took me some time to discover there was this issue. And then when I, you know, I thought, well, that's interesting, I'll include that. But when I talked to people what I was doing, they said, well, are you going to deal with the plagiarism issue? And then I looked a lot more closely at it, and I had, and I saw that it had never been dealt with thoroughly or in its entirety. So I decided to make that a fairly large portion of the book, and I have to say that a lot of material in that portion of that chapter is new, hasn't been used before, because I do happen to be a very thorough researcher, and I went into the issue with no strong feelings, and interesting enough, I came out of it with no strong feelings. I think it's fascinating, because the most fascinating parts of history are gray areas, and this is a gray area. There's no facile answers. You can say one thing and that can be contradicted by something else. So where I come down is, in the end, after considering all the documentation that I can lay my hands on and talking to everybody that I can think of, and having a large number of people, including Sands, read a draft of that part of the book, is that everyone made mistakes. Everyone, meaning Stegner, meaning the Foot grandchildren, meaning the scholars who came down heavily on Stegner and didn't do their research, and meaning the defenders of Stegner who came down heavily on his side and didn't do their homework either. So that's what resulted in the end.
For people who are not familiar with this, I'll just read the note at the beginning of Angle of Repose. He says, "My thanks to J.M. and her sister for the loan of their ancestors. Though I have used many details of their lives and characters, I have not hesitated to warp both personalities and events to fictional needs. This is a novel which utilizes selected facts from their real lives. It is no sense of family history." Nonetheless, J.M. and her family were somewhat offended that people who knew who the model was might think that their grandmother had an affair. And in this case, I come down completely on Stegner's side, because he gave no indication anywhere of who J.M. was or who the model might have been.
Well, that wasn't hard for anyone who did a little work to figure out, because just about the same time, her reminiscences, her memoir, was being published by Huntington Library, and anyone even vaguely familiar with her life, which Stegner did a lot to bring to the attention of many people by first teaching her at Stanford and then including stories of hers in two anthologies, that would be a relatively few people who would be able to figure out. He was under the constraint of keeping the family anonymous. There had been an agreement. But at the same time, he felt he had to credit someone, J.M., Janet Michelow, if anyone could figure that out, for loaning him her ancestor's life, which I don't know if it includes, which he had to warp somewhat to fit his fictional purposes. So I would fault him in terms of that one paragraph in that part of the book, was not perhaps going a little bit further and making explicit mention that of the letters and so forth, so that the reviewers didn't credit him with writing the letters. He could have been a little bit more fulsome in his explanation, so that there was a really clear indication that much of this came from somewhere else. But at the same time, he was under this constraint, and there is the unfortunate allusion to an adulterous affair. His purpose was to make that neither one way or the other, was to make it very ambiguous. And if you read it, you can really go either way. And at the same time, a daughter, unfortunately with the same first name as Mary Halleck Foote's daughter, drowns in the irrigation ditch whenever what was going on was going on. So Agnes actually didn't die in Idaho. She died later in California. Those were the two places, one place where two incidents occurred that he had asked Janet Michelot, had warned her about, not that explicitly, but saying there's an event that happens here which I think you should read about, and you should read the whole manuscript. Janet was a very busy person with a lot of good causes, including the rampant growth that was going on in Nevada County at that time. And 600 pages was a rather daunting task, so she wrote Wallace Stegner, said thanks, but no thanks, I'll wait for the book to come out. Who knows? Everything's a very close call in this instance, and that's what makes it fascinating for me.
The bigger issue for many people, and I think Sands and among them, is not so much changing the life a bit as how much he took from Mary Halleck Foote's letters. Some of the most stunning parts, the descriptions, are taken whole cloth from things she had written. He did a beautiful job of incorporating them, but never indicated where he'd gotten that material.
Yeah, I'll just sort of, hello there, Philip, and all I right. want to say that I think your chapter just is a wonderful exploration of the issue, and I have to say what a fun it was palling around with you up here on that subject. It was great. I do think that there's a couple of quotes from the letters that I wish had been put in as well, and particularly the one in which he wrote to her and to Janet Michelot and said, I'm not going to use many quotes from the letters or the reminiscences, just a sentence or two at most, is I think the direct quote from one of the letters. And that is in addition to when he wrote them and said, do you really want to read this 600 plus page tome? It'll take you a week or two or something. That I think there was some sort of perhaps, you know, indicate a lack of thorough indication of just exactly, and he may not have intended to quote as thoroughly as he, in the end, ended up doing.
And so that first quote is in the book, and I do make the point that he, immediately after it, that he used much more.
Oh, good. All right. I'm sorry I missed that. But that's the sort of one issue that for me, that and the issue, which I do think you cover extremely well, that it's not so much the, although it's the quoting is an enormous aspect of the problem, but the fact that those people who recognized a life would assume the same. And I'm very glad how thoroughly you covered that in the piece. And, you know, in the end, I had this when I was working on the play Fair Use as well, that there is, which I'm not the first to come up with this phrase, but I can't credit it, that there is kind of a giggle factor where plagiarism is concerned after a while, because we can get all head up about this issue, but in the end, no one died. And I do think there's something very important about, as you point out, that I make the point of in the play, bottom line, it's to me, my eye, about acknowledging the source of the work, and that, you know, bottom line is sure. where I feel the problem was. And there's no question that it's a marvelous novel and that many, many people consider it one of their favorites.
Yes, actually, it's the only gray area. There's a few others. I sort of challenge him on his not contributing to the World War II effort when he didn't have to join the Army, but could have held a job in Washington. But no one really, other than myself, perhaps is concerned about that. And I think he's sort of sold out on the West in the end. He was very disappointed. It was a geography of hope, and then it became his geography of despair, and his ashes were spread in Vermont, where he thought there was more attention to the frontier code of behavior and history that there was. But
well,
getting back to there's always the context, and the book puts this, I think, in a wider context, and that was that this wasn't the only time he got in trouble for using somebody else's life.
That's right.
It goes all the way back to his first novel, Remembering Laughter, which I point out, and he wrote, he was a realist. He used things. He didn't get in a lot of trouble because most of the things he used was from his life, but whenever he went somewhere else, he got into some trouble, not everywhere. And there's another place in the book where I hope people will catch the context, and that is an exchange of letters with Fawn Brody, who was the biographer of Thomas Jefferson and brought up the Sally Hemings issue. Mm. And there's a wonderful exchange of letters where she says, you know, everything's fair game as long as it contributes to the character. And he said, no, personal lives are out. And then she comes back with, well, yes, in terms of Benny DeVoto, his personal life is out because you were a close friend of his. And then it goes on to the lesson that he learned from Angle of Repose, and that was that what he applied to Crossing to Safety based on his and Mary's oldest friends, Phil and Peg Gray. He went to their children, the six children, and said, if you have any objections to this book, I won't publish it. Well, none of them did. But he had learned something from the Angle of Repose issue. And I'd like to point out to the people who may feel I've treated favorably in one way or another, I made a real conscious effort in the epilogue to come back to Nevada City, as you know, and then to use that material that I gathered as a way to put Mary Halleck's life back into factual perspective after Angle of Repose ends.
That's excellent.
And it was one of the driving forces behind my decision to use Nevada City as the California chapter in the epilogue. So I did try to give Mary Halleck at least part of her life back.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. In with me in the studio is Sands Hall, author, among other things, of the play Fair Use. And on the other end of the phone is Philip L. Fradkin, author of Wallace Stegner and the American West. We have to stop at this point. We could take up the whole hour with no trouble. I'd like to let our listeners know that Philip Fradkin will be speaking at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park this Thursday at 7:30 p.m., and there's also a Wallace Stegner conference coming up. Is that correct?
There is. March 7th to 9th. It's the largest gathering of people who had something to do with Wallace Stegner in my hometown of Point Reyes Station. Robert Haas, the former U.S. Poet Laureate, is the host. Barry Lopez, William Kittredge, Annick Smith, Rebecca Solnit, a whole host of people will be in Point Reyes that weekend. There'll be field trips, there will be discussions, there'll be good food, and information on the conference can be obtained along with registration by putting Point Reyes Books into Google or emailing www.ptraysbooks.com, and I think it'll be a wonderful experience for all your listeners who are interested in not only what we talked about, but other facets of his life.
Thanks so much for being with us, Philip Fradkin.
Thank you.
It's a wonderful achievement, Philip, the book. Congratulations.
Thanks, Sands. I look forward to seeing you at the conference.
Me too. Thanks.
Sure.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be here till 2 p.m. First half of the program involves Sands Hall, who's a local author who's been on here many times. Right now, I've got Dale Pendle, who's also been on at least, I'd say, three previous times, and I'm very glad to have back. In the past, it's mostly been his own, specifically his own writings, the trilogy, Pharmacopoeia, Pharmacodynamis, and Pharmacognosis. This time, however, he's got a book on a related but fascinatingly different subject, Walking with Nobby, Conversations with Norman O. Brown, which relates five walks the two of them spent in the Santa Cruz area in the 1990s. It puts a lot of light on the evolving thought of Norman O. Brown for those of us who are interested. It got people like me who read all his books in the 60s and 70s, all the ones I could get a hold of, but hadn't picked one up in at least 20 years to grab them all out. If for nothing else, that's a great service, but it's also a fascinating book.
Books are due to come back.
Yeah. Just for people who might not know, I'll just say very quickly, Norman O. Brown was a classics professor at Wesleyan University when he wrote his book Life Against Death in 1969. It's subtitled The Psychoanalytical Meaning of History, and he takes the late theories, the beyond 59. The pleasure. Pardon?
59.
59. I'm sorry, did I say 60? Yeah, 59. He took the later theories of Sigmund Freud from Beyond the Pleasure Principle and later writings to analyze repression and liberation in human civilization. And it was a immensely influential book. I'd say he was one of the half dozen people who, whether he wanted to or not, may have created the counterculture of the 60s. It turns out from what you talked with him about that, he had no sympathy with the counterculture at all.
Oh, no, that's not true. I certainly didn't mean to imply that. He had great sympathy for the counterculture, but he was very uncomfortable at, I think, his sudden fame or notoriety and suddenly an international intellectual spotlight was placed on him, and it kind of surprised him, and I'm not sure he was comfortable.
I guess he was not comfortable with certain aspects of the counterculture, the drug use in particular, and some of the music.
There's no indication that Brown ever used any drugs other than alcohol for a time. But no, it may be going too far to say he was uncomfortable with that. There's some remarks in some of his interviews at the time which say something is needed. It is time for your young men to see visions.
But he does in your walks. He's constantly chiding you a bit for your drug investigations.
Well, yes, he chided me personally, but personal attack was Brown's customary mode of operation. I should say, you know, going for walks was his way of working with both students and colleagues. If you wanted to talk about something, if somebody contacted him, he'd say, let's go for a walk. He walked every time, so everybody's walks were different, and everybody had their own walks, but everybody that I've spoken to, they tended to be intensely personal. They were often confrontative. And richly memorable to all who took them.
And on the walks, it seems that I wouldn't say by any means retracted anything he had said, but I think he began to feel that he'd been too systematic in following. Early in his life, he'd been a Marxist and then a Freudian, and that he might have bought into these systems a little too much. Maybe his most memorable book, Love's Body, gets away from that by being essentially not a systematic writing, but a series of chapters on particular topics with short paragraphs, sometimes in a few cases just aphorisms, giving his point of view on topics like liberty, nature, trinity, unity, person, and so on. But I think he felt that he may have been a little too one-sided even there.
Well, it came up in our walks a lot. I walked with Nobby frequently during the last decade of his life, and in that time, he came to question. He was looking for mistakes in his work, and he said there are mistakes in love's body. For one, he said it's too Christian. And he was moving more towards the idea of chance and trying to find some way to, in the idea of chance, perhaps find one more key to push forward his program, which was really to find a Dionysian Christianity.
You mentioned in it that you started out as a scientist, particularly interested in physics, and had moved more and more toward mythology, ethnobotany, and related subjects, poetry.
Right, and right. Here I find NOB on our first walk saying we must embrace science.
So he'd gone exactly opposite directions. What meeting places did you find on these two opposing trajectories?
I guess the common ground was poetry, and Brown had moved a lot closer to poetry, and Love's Body is written like a long poem. It's I think maybe there was some influence by Robert Duncan, and I don't know, discovering a new poetic form, I think, which was articulated further in his little pieces, Actaeon, and his hymn to Daphne. So through poetry, we would, trade verses back and forth on our walks that we knew by heart. I tried to show off at first, and he just kind of kept very quiet for a while or would give a slight nod. And it wasn't until we'd been walking for some time that he began to give quotes himself, but they were often, long and in Greek.
The poets concerned range from, aside from the classics, Greek and Latin, Shakespeare, Marvel, Milton, Keats, Yeats, Swinburne, those are just a few of the ones who come to Shelley come to mind. He had a very wide knowledge of
poetry. And he also knew contemporary work. He knew Olson and Duncan and Snyder and Spicer, and kept up on that.
The essays that you have in here, there's after the walks, there are two appendices that are, the first in particular is written in almost a free verse form, and the second is in more conventional blocks of prose, but it really has, each paragraph is sort of a dwelling on a particular topic and then moving on to another. He seemed to get more and more comfortable with that way of sort of phenomenalizing particular ideas.
Yeah, I think his aphoristic poetic style kind of peaked in the 70s, and then he gradually moved away from it. He was trying to write a book called To Greet the Return of the Gods. And he wrote Actaeon, he wrote Daphne, but I think he stumbled on Narcissus, which was written in prose. His poetic style and that approach is most developed in the book that he did on Joyce and Vico called Closing Time. What I try and do here with the walks, and actually there's a large number of walks which are kind of condensed into these five, is to give some idea of the breadth of his thought, his style, his personal style, and the ferociousness of his intellect. questioning, ready to question everything, and follow an intellectual argument, a mythopoetic argument, wherever it might go.
And some of it is pretty recondite. I mean, there are
I was kept so busy keeping up with him. It was my graduate school. I had to read all the time just so I wouldn't look too dumb on the walks.
You said that you considered going back to graduate school and he discouraged you from doing it, and I guess this was the alternative.
Nobby was adamant. He said, not for you. And I thank him for his wisdom.
Do you think he was, you said, you speak about the for the return of God's unfinished work. Is that, what do you think he would have been expressing in that?
Well, judging by Daphne and Actaeon, it would have been a superb literary creation. I know of no other pieces like those two that weave the stories that take an old myth, like the story of Daphne, and pull in every resonance to it, every literary and philosophical reflection or meaning that the story can have, and look at it different ways. He was following Dante's scheme, the medieval scheme, where everything, every story had four meanings. This was very important to his thought. Nobby was the enemy was literalness, what Blake called single vision. So you needed to be able, in medieval times, it was kind of a game. It was what you're supposed to be able to do, is show the four ways of looking at a story. The literal, the analogical, the allegorical, and the anagogic. And Nobby saw literalism, or frozen meaning, as idolatry, and they don't. It's abandoning the intellectual play and celebration. It cuts out Dionysus and becomes wholly Apollonian, to use the terminology he preferred.
And it seems that from sort of exhorting people in especially in Life Against Death, he has a very clear criticism of human civilization, especially 20th century, and wants to free us of the repression, wants to liberate us. In the later works, he seems more concerned just with giving examples of how to look at things. Or do you think he still has that liberating goal?
The two
goal
are certainly linked. No, he was always concerned with freedom from repression. That remained his abiding passion. And I think he refined his insights in Life Against Death, which was to extend the later Freud's ideas to see civilization as neurosis. Freud's idea, actually. It's all there. In Love's Body, seeing coming in the poetic principle, the principle of metaphor and multiple meaning, a way out, that there was a playfulness, and instead of getting stuck in the idea of single truth, that in a poetic, metaphorical, polysemous alternative, there might be hope for tolerance and for people to free themselves and get along together.
in some, especially in the last walk or two, he basically says humanity is doomed. Has he, do you think he really felt that, or was he just trying to provoke you?
It's often hard to tell. It hardly matters, I think. We would always accept a thesis as genuine to work with and to see where such a thing would lead. Looking around at the history of the last century, that bloodiest of centuries, it's hard not to believe in the death instinct.
And it might be getting worse.
Looks like it could be nip and tuck. All the more reason to look and see what answers we can find from the long heritage we've had of people thinking about these things and trying to find a way out. And I think Nobby would see it as a play of forces, perhaps way beyond our control. When Dionysus appears, which is the way he would talk about it, traditionally Dionysus comes unannounced, unbidden. He just appears. Everybody knows trouble will follow. However, the suppression of Dionysus is worse. That leads to the sacrifice of children and very dark times, great prison systems, and the satanic mills. So, though things are never rosy when Dionysus appears, we can say his view was certainly it's our only hope.
And he's much more interested, he says again and again, in the group, the species, rather than the individual.
That's true. That's true. That came. That became more important in his work with Chance, in his last years in particular. That's quite correct.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and this hour has gone by way too fast, first talking with Philip Fratkin about Wallace Stegner, and now with Dale Pendle about Norman O. Brown. Dale's book is called Walking with Nobby, Conversations with Norman O. Brown. It's just been published by Mercury House and should be available. If it's not, tell them they need to get it. So thanks so much. This has been Booktown, as I said. Stay tuned now for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party.